I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to The Connection. As we get ready for the country's 250th anniversary, we're still struggling to reconcile our historic disagreements over what it means to be an American and how we view the role of government. Now, there are many ways to define those differences, red and blue, urban and rural, male and female, young and old, native and immigrant. Our guest historian Colin Woodard says our geography has a powerful influence on the policies and beliefs and values we hold dear. His new book, Nations Apart, shows how early colonists, with their differing views of individual liberty and the common good, created a, quote, awkward federation of distinct regional cultures, unquote. He writes that it's these 11 regions with their unique narratives and traditions that drive our current conflicts over authoritarianism and democracy. He joins us today on The Connection to discuss what's pulling us apart and how we can create a more perfect union. Colin Woodard is director of Nationhood Lab, and that's at Salve Regina University's Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy. He's also a former foreign correspondent. And Colin Woodard, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Marty.
You know, I was wondering how to begin the show, and I wonder, is it helpful for us to think of America as either a forced marriage or a marriage of convenience, that we came together to fend off the crown, but had so many things that we did not agree on from the very beginning?
Yeah, it was an accidental marriage. I mean, there was a change in British imperial policy in the 1770s that threatened each of the colonies' own ways of doing things, the idiosyncrasies of their political cultures, their power structures. That was all at risk. So they banded together, not because they were friends. They'd been, throughout the colonial period, rivals for land and settlers and capital. They'd been on opposing sides of the major colonial conflicts like the English Civil War and the Glorious Revolution, but they did not want their local ways to be destroyed by Britain's demand for conformity. So they ganged together in a sort of ragtag rebel alliance, and lo and behold, they won. But in doing so, they found themselves together in something called the United States of America, and nobody was really sure what that was. You know, is it supposed to be a nation state? Is it supposed to be, you know, the equivalent of today's NATO, like a defense alliance, an EU? And that wasn't clear to people when the war ended. It wasn't clear to people when they were writing the Constitution. Even as you moved well into the, you know, second and even third decade of the 19th century. So we've been created ex post facto. We had a country in theory before we even knew what it was or had a story as to what made one a United Statesian instead of a Connecticut or a South Carolinian.
In fact, you say the kind of essential tension between these regions, or perhaps even in the country today, is the common good versus the individual. It's understandable to think about how that tension can have such a long-lasting impact.
Absolutely. I mean, these different regional cultures, they tie back to the different colonial projects, right? The Puritans in New England had totally different ideas, ethnography, religious background than the, you know, second and third sons of the great English, you know, manor families who weren't going to inherit the estate at home, you know, the Downton Abbey. But suddenly with a new world being created, they could come to the Chesapeake country and have a dream of recreating their own manor estate as the second son or third son. Those are two completely different projects. One's conservative and aristocratic, and the Puritans' project was, they were a people who thought that they were in a covenanted relationship with God, like the Old Testament Hebrews, and had been chosen on a mission from God to create a more perfect society. And they were going to do it as a group, and they would be punished or rewarded as a group for their success or failure. The individual could mess things up. So, you know, you have a people on a mission doing it together through shared institutions. And on the other side, you have the individual liberties of the great aristocrat, or even more intensely, the regional culture created in the back country, starting in southwestern Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh. That was the core of it. Scots-Irish immigration coming through Philadelphia, because the Quakers had a relatively open immigration policy. And that spread over a vast part of the interior of the United States. And that was a culture of people whose experience had been that in the lowlands of Scotland, in Northern Ireland, in the English marches, had been that institutions didn't exist, and that government, when it showed up, was usually trying to kill you with, lances and arrows. So you had to protect your kith and kin yourself. It's all about individual freedom, personal autonomy. Do not trust the institutions. Don't trust the government, who will be aristocrats. So yeah, one is so then you have this continent-spanning federation being created, and there's a project in theory to be a free society. How can you create a world where individuals can be free? And one experience would tell you maximize the autonomy and freedom of the individual, because government is going to be a despotism. The less government, less taxes, less regulation you have, the more free you'll be. And the other group saying, no, you have to build and maintain the infrastructure and institutions that were built up over 5,000 years of human despotism that make it possible for individuals to be free, so that each person, when they're born, has, a chance of being free, of achieving their potential, regardless of the circumstances of their birth. Because otherwise, the gains will accrue to a few families and you have an aristocracy. So that's the big, yeah, communitarian versus individualism, and the regional cultures are separated by historical experience in their emphasis on that.
You're describing, as you describe, Yankeedom, which is that more Puritan part of the country at its founding, and then the Deep South, which has this aristocratic, and obviously there's slavery as part of that. But here we are, 250, 300 years later. Are we still, still fighting those or in conflict over those two values, because we've had so much migration in and across and out of the country? We've had, 300 years of history and largely progress. What has allowed these parts of the country to hold on to these very old ideas?
Yeah, you'd think they'd be gone. Like you say, we've had mass migration across the country. We've had mass immigration, mass media, mass retailing. Certainly, whatever effects of these rival, colonial projects and the mutually exclusive settlement areas each of them had through the 1830s, certainly they would go away by now, right? But
Right.
at Nationhood Lab, we run data at a county level. I've mapped the original, settlement streams at a county level and just left it there and said, okay, do we see any differences? You see differences when you map county level data on almost everything: elections, diabetes rates, life expectancy, FICO credit scores, where immigrants go and don't go, and where they went in the past, where they go today. You can often see at a county level almost the affinity between these regional cultures. So the question is, how can that possibly be?
Right.
And there are a few reasons for that. I mean, culture is a powerful thing. Even in the absence of the people, like the ideas that were laid down by the early colonists, even if their numbers are really small, they set down the institutions and the norms and the stories of who we're supposed to be and what we're supposed to celebrate, that the rest of us, who might be far more numerous, had to encounter and sort of deal with. So there's that. But there's also the fact that the reinforcement of these things over time, like as people move around, people are not moving around randomly. Social scientists who've tracked people today as they move from place to place, they see that, they look at canceled driver's licenses and then track the driver's licenses, and then they go interview
Wow.
the people. Yeah, that's social, not me, thank
Amazing,
goodness, but
right?
someone else has done this
Someone is
kind of
doing
work.
this. Yeah, I hear
The
you.
basic lesson has been that when they interview those people, political attitudes, the political attitudes in aggregate of movers, they resemble their destination more than their point of origin. In other words, in aggregate, people who are frustrated, the place that maybe they were born and grew up in, because every single county and every single region, you have the full range of individual opinion. It's just, do you feel that you're among your people, that this is the society that, is accord with my values? Or have you always been frustrated at all the unexamined assumptions of the society around you? Oh my gosh, people here believe that A and B are true when I know it is X and Y. I'm so frustrated. If I ever had a chance, if my company ever let me relocate, I'd relocate somewhere where people believe X and Y, because I'm so fr and people do that. And in doing so, they are sorting themselves. So what we see in the data, for instance, in elections, is places aren't becoming more purple, The blue regions are becoming more blue and the red regions are becoming more red because people are sorting themselves on the map.
I wonder too whether part of culture, which of course is a big category, and its identity and its songs and but also stories. I mean, the power of narrative to make one feel that you're part of this culture, that you identify with people who share some of your same values. How powerful is that?
Yeah, and it's enormously powerful because humans, we're a storytelling species. That's how we organize information. That's how we figure out who we ourselves are in our internal thinking. You're a teenager, you're trying on different identities. There's a story in your head about what each identity means. We have all have multiple identities, Phillies
Indeed,
fan,
right.
Jewish, Pennsylvanian, and working on up. And your regional culture has an enormous effect on all of that stuff, just as any culture does. But the top level story of what your nation is, that is one of the most powerful and consequential of stories. And it's something that people are aware of, that is contested, that's engineered. And every nation needs one, because remember, nations are imaginary, right? We believe they exist because we believe they do. Why do you and I have more in common with somebody we'll never meet 3,000 miles away than we do with someone in Ontario who's much closer? It doesn't make a lot of sense, except that there is a story that we all share as Americans or as Canadians that's different. That story, the battle over a national story, is important for every country. But if you're in a federation that's really a federation of a bunch of regional cultures that are really have the attributes of stateless nations, your story of United Statesianness is going to be incredibly important.
Well, we're almost up on a break here, but let me just pick up on that. So you're saying that these regional stories are more powerful or more potent than a national story that can hold a country or perhaps even this country together?
Well, all of the regions have a cultural heritage that gives a predilection towards certain ideas, ideologies, values, the religious heritage, the adapting of different religions depending on what region they're operating in, which is why we have, Southern Methodists and Northern Methodists because of the Civil War. I mean, these things are powerful forces. But also, as you're implying, some of these regional cultures had stories of their own.
Right.
Sometimes they believe that their story is the story of America writ large. Sometimes they are conscious that they are captive in a United States and that they are distinct, but those stories matter a lot, especially the ones from the regions who had the pretension to assume that they spoke for the country at large. Yankeedom, the greater New England cultural space for sure, but others as well. And the conflict between those ideas, you can see all the time if you've got your antenna up for it, even today.
Indeed. Well, a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with historian Colin Woodard. He's got a new book that we're talking about. It's called Nations Apart. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. A quick recap here. There is a battle raging about what it means to be an American, what kind of country we want to be. Our guest, historian Colin Woodard, says this is a conflict that's rooted in our nation's founding and the longstanding struggles over things like immigration and guns and history and democracy. And again, he's got a new book called Nations Apart: How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. Let me just pick up on what you were talking about right before the break and talk about our Civil War, because it seems it's not raging on, but we are still fighting about the Civil War, whether it's taking down Confederate statues or putting them back up again, whether it was a war over states' rights or a war over slavery. It seems to me that we have not reconciled what this war was about, and we're, 100 plus years beyond the Civil War. Why do you think this has such resonance?
Because, I mean, the Civil War is, in a sense, a symptom for our real meta struggle, our eternal struggle as the United States. And that struggle has been, how do we define our common purpose and why this country exists? That's this accidental federation. And they were, by the 1830s, they needed a story because everyone knew that without a story as to what being an American was, The country was going to fall apart. And there were stresses and secession battles. And two stories emerged in the antebellum period, almost at the same moment. One of them said, oh, what our real purpose is, those words that Jefferson wrote in our opening statement as a people, our sort of mission statement, the Declaration of Independence, that's our purpose, to create a society where the natural rights ideals in the Declaration can be secured, a society where every human has an equal moral right to survive, to not be tyrannized, to pursue their happiness as they understand it, and to take part in the representative self-government that makes that possible. We are a people devoted to a quest to create, for the first time, massly, a universally free and sustainably free society. And American is someone devoted to those ideals. But that was challenged directly in real time in the 1830s by a counter-narrative anchored primarily with deep Southern intellectuals that said, no, Jefferson was wrong. Humans are not equal. In fact, only the superior Anglo-Saxon race could possibly achieve the ideals in the Declaration. We're the ethnostates of this Anglo-Saxon race. And the United States is our protective, alliance and defense structure to protect these fledgling Anglo-Saxon states. In fact, we're a classical republic, like ancient Greece or Rome, where a tiny minority at the top of the pyramid has the liberty or privilege to practice democracy, and subjugation and slavery are the natural lot of the many. So it was ethno-nationalists tied to bloodlines, having the right bloodline, originally Anglo-Saxon. It adapted over time, but the key point is there are always people who are excluded from this circle of belonging. There's a master ethnic group or bloodline. And the only way that in a diverse society you can have a society that is an ethno-state is through authoritarian means to keep down the perhaps majority of people who don't belong to that. And you can see, so that was the battle of the antebellum period and the Civil War and Reconstruction and Southern redemption and the Jim Crow period and the Civil Rights period. And it's the battle today. It is the meta battle, and the Civil War is a subset of that. Our fight over the Civil War is either to obscure that that is what the battle is over, which no academic or historian would think there's even a discussion over it. It was about slavery. Or who's right now, which is a little bit more scary, especially when you have people like Vice President Vance essentially coming out on the ethno-nationalist side in formal speeches, and the official organs of the federal government on their Twitter accounts tweeting some of the most famous images endorsing a sort of, Anglo-Protestant supremacist ideas about our history. So we're in difficult times now.
Are you
Familiar
saying,
ones.
though, that our democracy, if it isn't collapsing, it is in peril, as you see it?
Oh, absolutely. In a sense, both. I mean, we're already, a political scientist who's being fair would call us a hybrid regime now. We're no longer a fully free and democratic society. Rule of law is not being implemented. The Constitution is not being enforced in obvious ways. I mean, the most, comically and hyperbolically is the president, without advanced warning and completely unlawfully, knocking down the East Wing of the White House. I mean, that's not, you can't do that, and yet it's being done. So we're also not yet a, authoritarian, dictatorship. We just had, free and fair elections where the opposition party, routed the ruling party. So we're not there yet, but we're in between. And that's the, the scary spot to be in. It is much harder to get out of a authoritarian dictatorship than once it's happened, than it is to prevent it before it consolidates. So that's really what's happening today.
You're right. Instead of taking some of that early history and moving to the 1960s, you say it really wasn't until the 1960s that America became a true democracy, or maybe
Correct.
even a truer democracy, whether it had to do with civil rights or women's rights or gay and lesbian rights, that all those seem to
Absolutely.
all kind of coalesce around that period of time.
Yeah, so I mean, we were not a Western democracy, a liberal democracy, small L, small D, a society with, attributes like the Declaration wants you to have, until the 1960s, not the 1860s, because with the collapse of Reconstruction, Lincoln's pledge at Gettysburg, his call to the first time a president had ever called on the American people and said, yes, the Declaration is our purpose as a country. It is not destined. We have to fight for it. That this is what this war is about, he said, you know, on the battlefield in Gettysburg, and you know, it might perish from the earth if we don't fight for it. But after the Civil War, yes, the South lost the war, but they did in fact win the peace because Reconstruction was allowed to end without implementing the Declaration's ideals. We did get, while the Deep Southerners and Tidewater congressional delegation had still not been readmitted to Congress, that's when we passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which is the first time that we had operationalized the Declaration in our Constitution. But even so, with Reconstruction's collapse, those, you know, the 14th and 15th Amendments were largely ignored by the Supreme Court, and a terrorist campaign by the KKK and others, you know, reinstalled a white supremacist system in the former Confederacy, right down to having a one-party state, you know, backed by, you know, a formal racial apartheid states with one-party control backed by both formal law and death squads whose members were often the sheriffs, policemen, and even judges who were supposed to implement the law. That is obviously not a liberal democracy when, you know, half of your country's population is living in a regime like that. So yeah, it's only in the 1960s and then on that we have actually been that a free and democratic society. In other words, in living memory, it is not inevitable. You have to fight for it. And
not to be naive or to let America off the hook, but we are in human history, a relatively new form of government, right? Yeah. Where you actually elect people and they are allegedly, you know, responsible to the people that put them in office versus a dictatorship or something even worse than that. So is it we're still sort of seeing our way when you look at the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment, which had to do with equal protection under the law and the end to slavery and giving Blacks the right to vote, and then you follow a couple decades later with, you know, Birth of a Nation and as you say, Reconstruction and Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, and Woodrow Wilson, you know, that was the first time that one of these stories, the civic national story tied to the ideals and Declaration, or the ethno-nationalist one, the first time that one of them actually succeeded in ruling federation-wide by consensus was the bad one. Under Woodrow Wilson in the 1910s and 1920s, we had an ethno-national regime, right? Birth of a Nation, segregation of the federal government, the passage of the 1924 Immigration Act, which was setting up ethno-racial quotas to protect the alleged Anglo-Saxon character of the country when they were putting up most of those Confederate statues we were until recently tearing down. I mean, that was a bad period, but that's how powerful the un-American, I will say, counter narrative is that it was in control first. And we may have thought that in the 1960s, the civic national narrative had its triumph, and then fast forward and we elected an African-American president and reelected them. It's like, you know, we're putting our demons behind us. But no, the forces of the bad side of our story were still out there and are here today.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Cullen Woodard, our guest today on The Connection. He's got a brand new book. It's titled Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America, talking both about our history and some of the present-day challenges that we face. You mentioned President Obama. Do you think part of this sort of toggling back and forth between authoritarianism and some form of belief in our Declaration of Independence, that naturally led to then to Donald Trump?
I mean, I think that was, even apart from regions, I think it's pretty clear that Obama's election definitely played a role in the rise of the Tea Party as a precursor to Trumpism. And the Tea Party was able to set the sort of first stage of the rocket, if you will, you know, capturing certain state governments to build the possibility that somebody like Donald Trump could come along in 2016 and actually rocket to control of the White House. So yes, there's definitely, you know, relationships there.
You mentioned J.D. Vance, the vice president, and he apparently has given this speech a number of times about what it is to be an American. And I'm quoting him, who was in an article that you wrote for the New York Times. He says, America is not just an idea. We are a particular place with a particular people and a particular set of beliefs and way of life. He goes on to say, the people whose ancestors fought in the Civil War have a hell of a lot more claim over America than the people who say they don't belong. Again, it feels like you're saying this is this essential argument. Are we about ideas, yeah, or are we about sort of blood and soil?
Yeah, and he even goes on to explicitly say that the Declaration is inadequate in two ways. One, for being too permissive. The Declaration's promise that anybody who believes in those ideals can potentially be an American, Vance dismisses in that speech as being sort of outrageous. And secondly, that someone who doesn't believe in those ideals, someone like the Confederates who fought against them in the Civil War, the idea that they are not totally American, he finds outrageous too, that there's a link between the ideals and the identity. And he makes the argument that the particular peoples he's speaking of that constitute Americans are those descended from the people who conquered the continent from indigenous America or who fought in the Civil War, and that that somehow is more privileged than somebody who came after the end of the Civil War, which, you know, and the continent was closed, rough, you know, the Census Bureau famously said in 1890, there is no frontier anymore. So J.D. Vance is kind of closing the door on the 1880 to 1924 immigration wave, which happens to be the immigration wave where non-Protestants arrived in large numbers, and, you know, that they are not included, and that the number of people, African-Americans, who were able to actually fight in the Civil War was very, very small. You couldn't in the Confederacy, and there were only, you know, a few units in the Union Army. So he's that definition, if you think about it, ends up excluding an awful lot of people. So it's kind of amazing to see somebody forcefully, as sitting vice president, being declaring that that is the case and that the Declaration is inadequate by comparison.
You mentioned African Americans, and I'm wondering those that live in the Deep South, you know, that grew up under this same sort of culture and history, though, we know have created their own unique narrative, even within this sort of regional narrative that's largely about white supremacy, for instance.
Right. And that has been true, you know, Deep South, Tidewater, that's always been the case. You know, who are oftentimes, you know, as a historian, you know, I'm a white guy from a rural, very white state. But as I studied our country's history, I was just blown away at the degree to which our liberal democracy, you know, small L, small D, has been saved again and again by African Americans. And, you know, Frederick Douglass was fighting and arguing before Lincoln at Gettysburg for the civic narrative. He wasn't just saying, you know, you're not bringing these ideas, you're oppressing African Americans. He was saying, you have these ideals, they're great ideals, you should implement them. And he defended, you know, women. He was involved, like almost the only man involved in the Seneca Falls, you know, Women's Rights Convention. He was defending Chinese during the Chinese Exclusion Act era. He was defending Irish when they were being kicked around. Whoever was being left out in his times of the promise of the Declaration, he was defending. So, yeah, way ahead of most everybody else.
Well, and it's interesting to, again, sort of toggle back and forth between the history and the present, because it's clear the President Trump, I mean, he targeted immigrants. That was really his sort of opening salvo in 2015. And we are a nation of immigrants, and yet we have fought immigrants coming to this country from the get-go, whether they were Irish or Italian or anywhere else in the world. But do you think there's something unique about the way that Trump has targeted immigrants, whether it has to do with calling them diseased or whether it's limiting their immigration, even going after some of the more sort of tolerant policies, that there's something unique about the way that he has gone after immigrants?
He's actually, and this is more disturbing, playing from a well-honed playbook and in a deep tradition of, you know, white supremacist or ethno-nationalist rhetoric applied all over the world and in this country. And he's specific. He's not against all immigrants, right? He has enthusiastically opened America's doors in his second term to allegedly oppressed white South Africans from South Africa at the same time he's shutting the door to others. He's, expressed, he said in the past, why can't we have, more Norwegians, not people from these blankety blank countries, pejorative, right? That there's a clearly a preference for certain ethno-racial groups and in the way that he's implementing his immigration policies. So that has a deep and long tradition, right? During that big 1880 to 1924 immigration wave that
Yes.
so profoundly changed America, ideas about American identity. You didn't have to be Protestant anymore eventually after that. Catholics, Orthodox Christians, and Jews at least could be full-fledged Americans after that. But that was fought kicking and screaming. Everybody was, in Protestant America, there was, the horrors of the Papists will come and these people from Eastern Europe and from Italy, they're too different. They can't possibly become good members of the Republic. Woodrow Wilson in his histories is attacking them as the sort of, spoils and inferior dregs of the world being thrown on our shores. So yeah, it has a long tradition that unfortunately echoes in history rather than something new under the sun that Trump's bringing out.
Again, almost a minute before our second break here, but what we see though are immigrant groups perhaps just fighting their way into our society, saying that we belong here. But there's so much tension over that today, certainly today, and I know in the past.
And the regions had different attitudes about immigration and what constituted being an American or who belonged. Like the Midlands, which is the regional culture created in Philadelphia, the origins go with William Penn and the Quaker experiment. But the Quaker experiment was, they, unlike the Calvinists in New England who thought that, humans are ultimately depraved, you got to keep an eye on them, they're going to
Yeah,
go waltz with the devil,
right.
right?
Yep.
Quakers are like, no, there's an inner light. People are all right. And one of the effects of that was an incredibly open immigration policy at a time when that was not the case in the other colonies. So it quickly became a refuge for whoever was trying to escape Europe. And you had people of many ethnicities, nationalities, religions coming. And, you had Shakers and Mennonites and German 48ers later. And, whoever had to get out of Europe was often coming through Philly into the Midland settlement zone, which goes through the central band of Pennsylvania and eventually, and through the middle band of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and fans out. And that's a multicultural place, a mosaic of people bring their own culture and keep it.
We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation with Colin Woodard. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Colin Woodard. He's director of the Nationhood Lab, and that's at Salve Regina University's Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy. He's also got a brand new book we've been talking about called Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. And he has spent many years working as a foreign correspondent. In fact, Colin, let me pick up on that. You worked as a journalist in Eastern Europe at a very pivotal time in that part of the world's history. What did you see, and what do you think you learned that can apply to America today? This, of course, was, the ending of communism, but as we know,
yeah.
so many regional battles there as a result of the end of that era.
Yeah, I mean, I graduated from high school in 1987, and the perestroika, glasnost, Gorbachev, it seemed like something exciting might happen. So I was studying that region, well, it was still the Iron Curtain in the Soviet Empire. And in 1989, I was an exchange student in Budapest behind the Iron Curtain when communism collapsed. And I saw many of those events firsthand. And, I was already studying. I wanted to stay. So I essentially became a journalist so I could stay and see what would happen and travel around. And I did that throughout my 20s and most of the 1990s, watching the efforts to recreate societies after despotisms, battles over what is our history. Now that we're allowed to look at the past, who are we supposed to be? Who belongs and who doesn't? We're Hungary, the land of the Magyars. Well, there's Slovaks living in the Pilish Hills. Are they Hungarians? What about the Gypsies? We're not so sure. Hey, remember Hungary used to be a lot bigger before World War I? I mean, these things were going on in all of these countries at the same time they were trying to create liberal democracies where, in some cases, none had ever existed, where they hadn't existed since the 1930s, which had its own baggage. And then you had demagogues arriving who were using story and narrative and big lies in order to cynically keep themselves in power, extend their power by getting people to do horrible things. Trying to, Ion Iliescu in Romania, trying to trigger ethnic conflict between Hungarians and Romanians in Transylvania, Vladimir Mečiar in Slovakia, doing the same between Slovaks and Hungarians. Fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, but not with Milosevic and what happened in Bosnia. And the last phase of what I covered was the aftermath of the siege of Sarajevo and the Bosnian War and Srebrenica and, cities burned out and minefields everywhere, and people who both had been, purged, had their families wiped out, barely escaped, the ditch, but also encountering people who had done that and weren't at all apologetic about it, right? So that world of understanding how powerful story can be, your story of who your nation is, your history, how it can motivate people to do great and terrible things as well. I learned all those lessons, and they come into a lot of my work. But unfortunately, what I learned in Eastern Europe and the Balkans about human society, nationhood, identity, storytelling, and group foundation has become useful here at home.
I mean, are you saying, and obviously things are a little more stable now. I certainly remember the 1990s and what was happening in Eastern Europe. And of course, we've got Ukraine, and that's a whole other issue. But are you concerned that Americans can or will or could turn on each other in violent or sort of unjust kind of ways?
No, I mean, absolutely. We saw on January 6, an insurrection, a coup attempt in the capital that was enormously violent. I mean, we see that it's possible. It's possible for that to scale up. Obviously, it's in all of our interests for that not to happen. And the foolishness of it is that most Americans, don't want to live in an ethno-national authoritarian state. I mean, there's plenty of polling out there. It's like 70% of us definitely don't. It's not great if 25 or 30% of Americans do, but there's a super majority who really doesn't want that. And when we talk about, that civic declaration-based definition of our country, and you place it against the heritage, history, character stuff that J.D. Vance was talking about, the ethno-national adjacent. We actually at Nationhood Lab did polling to see
You
we had
did.
pairs,
It's
good pairs.
fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and we our job, which we've kind of done a lot of the work on, was to try to devise how can we talk about our good narrative story of ourselves today in a way that people understand? Because the ethno-nationalists have a story worked out that's very effective. The rest of us, the super majority of us, don't have a way of talking about it. So we were testing, and I thought, oh gosh, the heritage, character, history stuff sounds really concrete. I think we're going to be trying to sell people the broccoli, right? Because this sounds better than the airy philosophical, mumbo jumbo from the Declaration. So when we had our baseline poll results come back, and essentially was like 60-35, roughly, in favor of the Declaration, across, gender, region, generation, income levels, education levels, it blew my mind. And
And just to
including
underscore that, you're saying that when you polled people on, what is America, essentially, is it about our heritage or is it about the ideals and the ideas
right.
in the
Are we
Declaration of
ideals based
Independence?
or we, yeah.
Yeah. And you found that 63% of Americans, that's a pretty sizable majority, say we believe in the ideals of America.
Right. And only 33% preferred the other one, which I thought was going to win the race, which was, a surprising and welcome, but also shows that, most, including if you look at that breakdown, it includes 45% of people who voted for Trump in 2020. So, I mean, almost half of Trump's own voters don't like prefer the Declaration's values. And later we asked, just in a later poll, we was like, well, we better test whether Americans actually agree that, the poll question was, do you agree that as Americans we're duty bound to protect one another's, rights to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and so on? Because if we're not tied to protecting one another's, it's not going to work as a story. If we all just do what we want, that's not getting us anywhere. And I was like, well, I hope it's, 60-30, 60-40. It was 97-2 in favor. You don't see 97-2 on any polling question. Like our pollsters had like never seen a polling question that lopsided. If you ask Americans, is the Earth round or flat? And the Pew Research Center has, it's 80-10, 10% undecided. So I mean, 97-2 is incredible. I mean, yes, do people really stand up for those values?
Sure.
We tested, no, they don't always. But my point is that in the subconscious of Americans, that's actually what most Americans believe our country is for, so we can work with that because there's no need for us to be fighting with each other when we actually agree on a lot more than people realize, both in policy terms, but also on who we're supposed to be as a people.
I mean, how do you, if narrative is so important and you've got all these competing regional narratives, how do you create a national narrative that, what, 63% of the people, I mean, again, a sizable majority of the people can buy into? What is that narrative?
I mean, an effective national narrative to have the power to have us all accept membership in this imaginary yet important thing has to be rooted in history. It has to feel true in some level. It has to like emotionally move us to really, have that kind of power. And fortunately, those ideals in the Declaration are really good ones. They are rousing. It is Frederick Douglass in like every speech he made. It is Lincoln at Gettysburg. It's Martin Luther King Jr. on the Mall. It is the rousing civic national tradition that almost sells itself if you start speaking about it. It's the things that often Americans, when they look on their history, are most proud of. And people on the other parts of the world, when they're not mad at us, when they're happy with us, it's usually because we've moved and made an advance towards the Declaration's values. Values which, by the way, like we succeeded in exporting to the rest of the world. There are all kinds of countries that, even before World War II in Europe, Japan, South Korea weren't liberal democracies devoted to some equivalent of the Declaration. Now they are, and that really was exported from the US. Some of them may be doing a better job at it now than we are, but the ideals came from us, and it's, been a on balance, of far and away, a good development for humans.
Well,
So we want that to continue.
indeed we do. I mean, you describe the Declaration of Independence as a kind of operation manual, or operating manual, I should say. So, the
The
sort of
mission statement. Yeah.
or a mission statement for a country in this case. So why do you think we're so then, if there is so much consensus and so much inspiration that people draw from the Declaration of Independence, why does it not feel that way? And why do we have the kind of government that seems to represent something so very different? I mean, we're just coming off a huge government shutdown, for instance.
Yes, it's an ethno-nationalist and authoritarian-minded government. It's been fairly clear about that in the second term. How did we get there? Well, part of it is that we stopped talking about the purpose of the country and our civic national narrative after we won the Cold War. It wasn't, hey, free society, liberal democracies defeated, despotisms. It was communism was defeated by capitalism, go capitalism. And we could forget about nations and national stories that all nations will wither away. It'll all be about the movement of goods and services. Hey, look at what the EU's doing. That was, I remember that in the 1990s. And I was living in Eastern Europe in the Balkans. I was like, this is not how this is going to go down. But everyone's like, no, it's, those primitive Balkan people with their national stories and stuff. Where the rest of us have moved beyond that. We haven't, for better or worse, the way we humans are constructed, and people who work in, like human evolutionary, biology and child psychological development and political psychology know that, you need stories. If you don't have a story as to what the country is for, it doesn't mean you've just moved on and you don't no longer need those kind of stories. It means there's a vacuum. And as Jill Lepore, the New Yorker writer and Harvard scholar, has said, that vacuum will need to be filled, and it can be filled by scholars or it can be filled by demagogues, but fill it they will. It has to be filled. We left the vacuum, the demagogues came, and they filled that space uncontested with things that have brought us to a very dark place. And it's because we've forgotten how to talk about the other story, which is why at Nationhood Lab, we did this giant project to develop like a core one-page narrative frame about it, because it's that important to have that idea locked down in a way that is effective today with Americans.
In fact, you say part of this narrative should answer some questions. What is the purpose of America? Who belongs in America? What does our past mean? And where are we going? I mean, those are big philosophical, political, even psychological questions, but a really good story, it seems to me, contains all of that.
Yeah, I mean, those are the big existential questions. Who
Right.
are we? Where do we come from? Who belongs? Where are we going? And every nation needs those answers. And, Americans are ready. A vast, transpartisan, ecumenical, a super majority of Americans want that latently. It's just nobody's talking about it. And our leaders and stuff have kind of forgotten how to talk about it. So it's bringing this forward because this is the cohesion that'll this it's not now a battle between, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives. It's a battle between authoritarianism or the American experiment. And we're not used to framing it that way, but you need to, so that someone who is conservative or a Republican isn't being asked to join a camp that is labeled as being liberals and Democrats. It's bigger than that. It is a camp for the American experiment that goes from Liz Cheney to Liz Warren and can include, Republicans, Democrats, socialists, Greens, libertarians, whomever, who are devoted to that set of principles. So that's why we need that story. It's also the coalitionary story so that we can all, for these purposes, set aside our other battles. Well, we can fight them later, and those are
Sure.
all, legitimate political battles. But for this, that this is what we have in common, and it's desperately needed just so people can have direction and realize that they're not only are they not alone, they're a super majority force.
And are communitarian societies, are they happier, more prosperous societies?
In the individualism communitarianism front, and that's the battle which created the conditions that weakened our countries so that we could end up having a battle over ethno-nationalism versus our ideals. But the data, it's a legitimate political argument. Do you
Sure.
is it best to become a free society through, less taxes, less regulation, less government, or through investing in all those things? However, I would bring to the table when we have those discussions that inside Nations Apart, we ran data of all sorts. And the individualistic regions who tend to have low taxes and low services and low investment and low regulation, and whatever we looked at, fare badly. And the communitarian regions fare well, whether it's life expectancy, per capita gun violence rates, diabetes, obesity, credit scores, happiness indexes, social vulnerability. I mean, one can go on and on, and it's very clear the data is just telling you over and over again in different fields from different public data sources that economic libertarianism, makes you sick, die early, unhappy, poorer, and your economy worse. So, I mean, it's, we'll bring that to the political fight, I suppose it can be brought that we know which approach works better for people overall, but that's a fight for another day.
But that is that sort of as is often described, and again, we're almost up at the end of the clock here, but the sort of red state, blue state divide, right?
It does, and nowadays the red states and the Republican Party have had congealed prior to Trump around that less taxes, less regulation, less government will make you more free, but we've learned that actually, for individuals to be free, you actually do need some taxes, infrastructure, and government because that's what protects you from the rapacious, would-be oligarchs who will take your freedom away. Right? The classic in the old world, it wasn't the king and the peasants, it was the king, the nobility, and the peasants. And if you knocked off the king, the nobility would enslave the peasants, right? They'd be looking to the king to protect them. It's always been a three-way triangle between, the sort of today's terms, private capital, government, and the people. And you got to keep those things in some semblance of balance. If you think that there's only the king and the people, you're missing out on another way that you can end up in tyranny.
A lot of juggling there. Colin Woodard, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I did as well. And again, he's got a new book called Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. And he's director of Nationhood Lab at Salve Regina University's Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection, which airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can always listen to the WHYY app. You can follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find the show on Facebook. And check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows. Debbie Bilter produces the show.